Alaskans along the rail belt have relied on Cook Inlet gas for heat and power for decades. But the wells in Cook Inlet Basin, a long reliable source of natural gas for homes and businesses, are no longer so reliable, with potential shortages looming in the next few years. Why isn't more gas being developed in Cook Inlet? What's the potential for renewable energy replacing gas, and what will it all mean for ratepayers if gas needs to be imported? We'll discuss the future energy needs for South Central Alaskans against diminishing supply today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Residents of Anchorage who have lived in the city for a long time may remember the Winter Light Competition at the end of the 90s, where you could win Alaska Airlines tickets for festive light displays during the darkest days of winter. Then, just a few short years later, a new push to conserve amid the fear that rolling blackouts may be needed. Then concerns were quieted as supplies stabilized after Hillcorp entered the Cook Inlet field and boosted production from aging fields. But the quiet calm has now been replaced by fresh anxiety over gas supplies in Cook Inlet and concerns over running out by 2027. What a roller coaster. So what happened? Why are we so close to running out of gas? And what's the best path forward to provide a reliable, affordable supply of energy for the more than 70% of Alaskans who live along the rail belt? Our guests are very focused on these very issues. John Sims is the president of NSTAR Natural Gas. Senator Bill Willikowski is on the line from Juneau and is an Anchorage Democrat who has sponsored legislation aimed at energy conservation. And Chris Rose is the founder and executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
You can also join us, Alaskans. Do you live along the rail belt and have questions about the future of energy supplies for South Central? Do you use renewable energy in your home or business now? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, John, I want to start with you. Describe the problem that happened last winter during a cold snap when there was an issue of sand coming out of one of the wells. What does that indicate and what had to be done in response?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here. It's a great chat with folks this morning. Late January, you know, I think everybody remembers how cold the temperatures got during that time. It was, you know, we were seeing, sub-zero temperatures and, you know, most importantly, sub-zero temperatures for a long extended period of time. And so anytime you have that scenario, you start stressing out the natural gas system, mainly on the production side. And so one of the things that we saw was our storage facility, which is Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Alaska down in Kenai, Alaska. We were using that facility very, very heavily. And some of the wells started losing deliverability, which is the rate at which gas can be produced from those wells. So we didn't actually produce sand to the surface, mm-hmm. But we started seeing that we were losing that deliverability. And so in an abundance of caution, we reduced the total capability of that facility by about 30% because we didn't want to further damage the wells in case we had some, consistent and long snaps of cold temperatures. And that was really where we started seeing the system as a whole was strained more than it ever has been before. We started, communicating with all the utilities and the producers to say, okay, here's the situation we're dealing with. How can we mitigate this to make sure that we can continue to serve customers? We had meetings every day at noon with our operations folks, with the folks at the oil companies and with the utilities to say, hey, what kind of tools do you have in the toolbox so that we can reduce demand on the system? Mm-hmm. The producers that do a great job in Cook Inlet, they were maxed out. We stopped sending power up the intertie, which is something that the electric utilities typically do because it's cheaper to produce gas here than it is in Fairbanks. We had to stop doing that. That reduced some of the demand. And then ultimately, the governor called on the military base and asked them if they could turn down their thermostats to reduce demand as well. So a bunch of different things that we had to do because of those challenges we experienced down at Tsingsa. It was a very, very stressful time.
It sounds very stressful. Sand and wells does not sound like a good thing at all.
Never a good thing.
NSTAR has contracts until 2023 or 2033, sorry. In a recent story, you were quoted saying, there is no market-based solution that's going to reduce the cost of energy to consumers. That's the unfortunate reality, and I think something the state of Alaska needs to accept. This sounds really dismal. Are you talking about short-term solutions?
Yeah, so it's got a combination of things. So, you know, we have contracts with Hilcorp that extend out to 2033 for most of our gas, not for all of our demand that we see in the future. So we're looking at short-term issues that we need to fix, and also long-term, and either solution at this point, if it's on, you know, unsubsidized, so if it's market-based, it's going to result in an increase in costs for consumers.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilikowski, I want to turn to you now. In 2022, Hilcorp said they didn't know how long they would continue to supply in the future. You referenced a USGS survey that says there's 19 trillion cubic feet of gas, plenty for decades, but you said Hilcorp isn't adhering to their lease. The FTC looked at the Hilcorp purchase in Cook Inlet and said, hey, this looks like a monopoly. The state responded with a consent decree. Describe what that consent decree does and what does this mean for consumers?
Well, thank you for having me, first off. And this is a really critical issue. And so what happened was Hilcorp acquired the assets in Cook Inlet, and they essentially assumed a monopoly position or a near monopoly. About 90% of the assets in Cook Inlet are under the control via leases by Hilcorp. And so the Federal Trade Commission opened up an investigation at that point because they were concerned that Hilcorp could use their monopoly power to withhold gas from South Central residents, and which could cause the exact, essentially the FTC predicted the exact situation that we're in right now. The state at that time responded by negotiating a consent decree with Hilcorp that required Hilcorp to continue to explore, produce, develop, and market their gas to the utilities. And so, in the last year or so, we've seen that Hilcorp has there's been questions raised about whether or not they are in fact doing that, because they have refused to sell firm gas contracts to the utilities up and down the rail belt. And so my office has looked into this. We sent two letters to the Attorney General asking for him to investigate. Part of the consent decree gives the Attorney General the authority to go in and request documents. The Attorney General never responded to us initially. After this got some more press, the Attorney General finally responded to us and effectively said he's doing nothing on it. The utilities, a number of the utilities, sent a similar letter to the Attorney General last year. They never got a response back from the Attorney General. So, there, according to the United States Geological Survey, there are roughly, the mean estimate is 19 trillion cubic feet of gas left in Cook Inlet. Now, to put that in perspective, since statehood, over 60 years, we have pulled out of Cook Inlet roughly probably less than 10 trillion cubic feet. So by that estimate, we've got, and that's including shipping gas, massive amounts of gas overseas to Japan. That's including the agrium down in Nikiski. And so there's roughly 100-year supply of gas by those estimates left in Cook Inlet. And we have one producer, Hilcorp, that has a 90% of the leases and is refusing to perform under the terms of their leases and under the terms of the consent decree.
You said if Hilcorp won't do the work, the state needs to get involved. It sounds like the Attorney General isn't interested. What do you think that should look like, and what kind of leverage can you bring?
Well, there's a lot of different leverage points that we have. There's a number of things that the state could do. And it could be as simple as the Attorney General going and investigating. And maybe Hillcorp is living up to the terms of their lease and consent decree, but without the investigation, we'll never know. And I think just the red face test, it clearly doesn't pass the red face test because they do control 90% of the leases. And we do know that they're refusing to offer contracts to the producers. So I think just a red face test alone, and the fact that we know there's 19 trillion cubic feet of gas there, it just doesn't meet that test. That's number one. So, you know, Hillcorp is receiving extraordinary tax benefits from the state. Hillcorp, when they acquired BP's assets, Hillcorp's owned by one Texas billionaire who doesn't pay any corporate income taxes because of his unique tax structure, the way he's incorporated in the state of Alaska. That's costing the state of Alaska roughly $150 million per year. And in fact, I have a bill to take away that preferential tax status that no other major producer gets in the state of Alaska. And one of the things that Hillcorp testified to last year was if we pulled their tax status and changed it and required them to pay corporate income taxes, that they would cut back on their on their exploration and production of Cook Inlet. Clearly, I think that's a violation of their lease terms. That's number one. Number two, Hillcorp is the beneficiary of roughly $700 million per year in tax credits up on the North Slope. And so, you know, the state has all kinds of leverage, not to mention taking away the leases. You know, the gas in Cook Inlet is costing them roughly $2 per 1,000 cubic feet to produce, and they're turning around selling it for $8. So the profit margins in Cook Inlet are staggering, but as much as they're making here, they're making even more on the North Slope. So they're directing their capital to the North Slope, where they're making more money, which is costing all of us up and down the rail belt.
You, back to the Cook Inlet concern, you warned that electric bills could rise by 50% or more in the next 5 to 7 years. What do lawmakers say about the urgency here? We're already losing population. Higher bills aren't going to help.
Yeah, there's a lot of urgency. And we're seeing a number of bills that are looking at how to address this. And they range from things like providing royalty relief to try to incentivize production in Cook Inlet, which is something we've tried over the years with marginal success. They range from some sort of state lending programs. We know that there are a couple other producers that we believe have large reserves of natural gas. There's Bluecrest, which estimates are they have 300 billion cubic feet of gas, which is enough to supply us for about 4 to 5 years. It potentially could be much more than that. There's Hex and Fury, which potentially has billions of cubic feet of gas. So there's some lending programs that people are looking into. And then there's Cook Inlet gas storage, which we need to expand. And so there are efforts to try to do that as well. And then, of course, the long dream of getting a natural gas pipeline off the North Slope is, I wouldn't say it's dead, but there is still some lawmakers who are looking at that as well.
And we'll talk about that in just a bit. But if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the Cook Inlet gas supply and the effect on consumers and businesses for about 70% of the state's population that lives along that rail belt grid from Kenai up through Anchorage and up to Fairbanks. We have on the line with us from Juneau, Senator Bill Willikowski, an East Anchorage Democrat who is working on these issues of the future for Cook Inlet supplies. John Sims is in the studio with us today. John is the president of NSTAR Natural Gas. And also in the studio with us is Chris Rose. Chris is the executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. Chris, thank you for your patience. I want to turn to you now. Every month, you said every month we delay gets us closer to higher gas prices. Senator Click Bishop was quoted in a recent story saying he has decades of studies that pointed to a shortage in Cook Inlet. Why is it so hard to get faster action and traction here with what could be a terrible problem for the majority of the state's population in a very few years?
Well, the short answer is probably institutional and cultural barriers that we've had here for a long time. But I think it's important to kind of frame this conversation for the listeners about gas here in Cook Inlet. About two-thirds of the gas is used for heating. About one-third is used for electricity production. The electricity utilities all have alternatives using renewable energy that uses technology today that people around the world are embracing. There are many places around the world that are using wind for 50-60% of their electricity already. There are many places, including Massachusetts, that's getting 18% of all their electricity from solar in Massachusetts. So this is not new technology anymore. It is commercial technology that the rest of the world is embracing. So there's a difference in interests between NSTAR, which is a heating utility, which has no other business model but to sell gas, and all the electric utilities, which, by the way, are also monopolies. And we have four of them, four co-ops up and down the rail belt. This is a big energy security issue. The nice thing about renewable energy is that it is local. We know that there are many renewable energy resources up and down the rail belt. And in contrast to all the problems we were just hearing about with getting Hillcorp or other investors to work in Cook Inlet, we have independent power producers who want to come to Alaska. But we need policy directives. We don't have a market. And this is one of the institutional barriers we have. We have four monopolies in the electric sector. We have one monopoly in the heating sector. So there's not a lot of competition that's going to be driving any change. Culturally, we've been able to rely on Cook Inlet gas for so long that it's just become the thing to go to. And it's the easy thing to go to, despite the fact that prices in Cook Inlet for our gas have gone up 500% since the year 2000. So today, as Senator Wilkowski just mentioned, our price is around $7.58 from Hillcorp. I checked today, Henry Hub prices in the lower 48 are $1.55 today. Mm-hmm. So even though we are producing gas locally, our market is so small that we can't attract or incentivize anybody to come up here to get a 50-year return.
So the rail belt grid, I think you said, has about 15% renewable energy currently, mostly hydro. What else is in the works that will come online in the next 2 to 3 years?
There are currently at least three wind projects that are before the electric utilities that are being considered by the electric utilities, which combined, if they were all built, and I'm just planning a kind of a medium build, not the maximum build, that would increase the amount of renewable energy from 15% to 40%. In the next few years. These are very large projects. There's one up by Fairbanks that could go anywhere up to 210 megawatts. There's one, Little Mount Susitna, which is closer to Anchorage.
Really, 200 megawatts it could produce?
Yeah, and the one at Little Mount Susitna could be up to 280 megawatts. Now, this is one of the things that people have to understand is there's a capacity factor, meaning the wind does not blow 8,760 hours in the year. Neither does our Bradley Lake hydro project produce electricity 100% of the year either. It's only got about a 50% capacity factor. So 50% of the time, we can dispatch water to make electricity from Bradley Lake. But those projects I just mentioned in Fairbanks called Shovel Creek and the one out here at Little Mount Susitna both have 40% capacity factors. So almost as high as Bradley Lake. And with the modern technology people are embracing around the world, which includes battery energy storage, as well as our natural gas and hydro facilities we already have, and more gas storage, we can integrate all of that renewable energy seamlessly like other countries are doing. I happened to be in Portugal last November when the whole country of 10 million people ran for six straight days on renewables. With no fossil fuel, six straight days, 10 million people. And so clearly we can do something like this in Alaska. My home state of Iowa is now over 55% wind. Now, that's not quite fair to say because it's a much bigger grid and they can sell that power elsewhere. But these countries around the world that are in that sovereign nations are often doing very high percentages of intermittent wind because this technology has come so far over the last couple decades.
Here's a question by email. A project that we haven't talked about in quite a while is the Susitna-Watonna Dam project. Someone wrote in and said, will the Susitna-Watonna Dam project be brought up? What is that project's status? This is from Nathan Sobolev in Juneau. Senator Has there been any more discussion about that hydro dam project?
There has been a little bit of discussion. I believe it was 2010, the legislature included funding in the budget to go to FERC to get a permit. I think we're a little bit short of getting all our permits for that project. But, you know, if we had done Susitna Hydro 30 years ago, we'd be having 4 cent kilowatt hour power right now up and down the rail belt, as opposed to the 14 to 21 cent per kilowatt hour power we have. And there has been local opposition to that has sprung up. And there's concern about some of the fish impacts in the area where the dam would be. But there is, you know, here's the thing with hydro. When the sun is shining, you know, you can get solar, but when it's not, obviously you don't. And same with wind. I think wind, you get about, what I've heard on these wind projects is you're getting wind about, I think, 20% and solar about 40%, or maybe they're flipped around. But with hydro, it's a constant baseload. And that's the same with natural gas. And so it's a much more valuable resource because you have that constant baseload that you can always rely on. I think with Susitna, it's still in the back burner. And if there were utilities willing to come forward, it's just a matter of financing it because it's a multi-billion dollar project at this point. And we do have, as Chris mentioned, we do have a number of IPPs that are independent power producers that are coming in that are putting on really significant amounts of power in the next few years.
What about the concerns of a changing climate and enormous hydro projects? How should we be thinking about that? Chris, maybe this is something that is anyone studying, that the fact that we know dramatic changes are possible and probable in the coming decades, especially to water flow and, you know, where water is going. Does that get considered at all in potential hydro project builds?
It certainly should, because we know that the climate is changing. We know hydrology is changing around the world. We know that it's also not very prudent to put all your eggs in one basket. That's what we've done with gas. 80 to 85%, depending on the water year, of the electricity that the southern utilities, not counting Golden Valley and Fairbanks, produce every year comes from natural gas. So we're 80 to 85% reliant right now on this cooking like gas that we're talking about. While Susitna could have been built 40 years ago, it wasn't. And now we would put a lot of stock in one project that does have risk, not only the water you're talking about, which is significant, but cost. We're hearing estimates up to $10 billion for a project that, again, also only has about a 50% capacity factor, meaning that you build a huge dam, but the reservoir is not big enough to hold water for electricity production more than half the year. So all of those things have to be considered in an apples-to-apples comparison, an integrated resource plan that is done with technical and economic feasibility analysis and with no interests in mind other than what's the best for the consumer.
John, for NSTAR, you have to have a gas supply, and so whatever renewables come online might help offset some of the need for gas, which could help NSTAR. But what are some of the other options? You mentioned something in an earlier interview called ISO containers. I hope I'm saying that correctly, to shore up cook inlet supplies. What are these?
Yeah, quite simply, it's small storage containers for liquefied natural gas. So it's sort of the easiest option, but it's also one of the most expensive. So it's not perfect. It's not ideal, but it's something that we could get up and rolling pretty quickly, as opposed to a larger scale, you know, importation project where, you know, there's massive infrastructure that's required to get the gas into our pipelines.
And this might not be a question you can answer, but I'll ask anyway. Is Cook Inlet more expensive to operate in than Prudhoe Bay? Are ocean rigs and platforms more expensive versus drill rigs up on the slope?
Well, I don't know that it's more expensive than up on the North Slope. I don't know those numbers.
Sure.
I can definitely say it's more expensive than Lower 48 as far as production and development. So, you know, you hear a lot of comparisons between Alaska Market and Henry Hub, and they're really not, you know, kind of going back to an apples and to apples comparison, they're not even close to the same. There are a number of different reserves, thousands of wells that bring gas into that Henry Hub market, and ultimately get delivered to millions and millions of people. And that's one of the biggest things that I think Alaskans need to understand is there are a lot of great projects across the world. But the key point that was mentioned in that project that delivered solar for 10 days was that was delivering to a population of 10 million people. You know, we unfortunately have a population that for the last 11 years consecutively have lost population due to net migration. So, you know, when you think of those things, we have less than 800,000 people in this state, which makes it really, really hard to do some of these projects that we're talking about. And that's really why a lot of these things haven't moved forward, because when you look at the cost for, you know, renewables cost for additional development in Cook Inlet, they're expensive because we don't have the demand to spread those costs across.
Mm-hmm. Before we take a break here in a couple of minutes, we're going to go to the phones. Jason is in Copper Valley. Hello. Jason? Well, maybe Jason had to step away. John, turning back to you, you said there are fewer entities, developers, that are willing to contract for gas sales. Why is that?
You know, I think it really just comes down to risk. You know, you look at the Hillcorps of the world, you know, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars or plan to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in the next couple of years to meet the contractual obligations that they have today. So that's not for new exploration and development. That's just to meet existing obligations. They have the balance sheet to do that. When you look at some of these smaller players, the Furies, the Bluecrests, they don't necessarily come with the same balance sheet, which makes it harder for them to expend significant resources that are required to develop and explore. So, you know, when we talk about firm contracts, what that means essentially is if they contract for gas with NSTAR or any of the utilities and it's a firm contract, they have certain ramifications for not delivering, and those are typically financial. And so if that's the case, as you're a small player, a small balance sheet, you think you can do something. As we all know, it's very, very risky in Cook Inlet for production and exploration. So if you don't get what you think you had, then you're unfortunately not meeting the obligations of your contract. That comes with financial ramifications, and they're at this point not willing to extend firm contracts because of that risk.
All right, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about what it's going to take to either incentivize more production or look for other options as we continue our discussion about Cook Inlet gas supplies as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about the Cook Inlet gas supply and the concern over looming shortages in as few as 3 years from now and what the options could be for shoring up that supply and bringing on other sources of energy generation in coming years. In the studio with me is John Sims, president of NSTAR Natural Gas, and Chris Rose, the executive director of REAP, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. On the line from Juneau is Senator Bill Willikowski, an East Anchorage Democrat who is working on these very issues. You can join our conversation if you have ideas or you use renewable energy and have thoughts about how it's helped your power supply in your home or business. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Dennis is in Portland. Hi, Dennis. Well, maybe Dennis is with our other caller somewhere. Senator, let's go back to you. You said that you see an opportunity for Alaska's LNG line since Russia has slowed or shut down gas shipments across Ukraine and the future of energy development and distribution is uncertain in Europe right now. Talk about what you see as the potential here and when do you think it could be viable? It's a project that's been hoped for decades.
I think with the geopolitical events around the world, it is creating an opportunity for us with Russia shutting down and limiting the amount of gas passing through Ukraine and limiting the amount of gas that's going into Europe. The explosion of the demand for LNG gas, which is cleaner burning than coal, which is cleaner burning than oil. I think there is an increased global demand for it. The question is, can Alaska do it in an economically competitive environment? I think inadvertently, when the Biden administration shut down LNG exports across the country, that actually gave Alaska a really competitive edge, because now we're one of the only games in town in terms of the United States. Because of our proximity to Asia, there's tremendous need and desire for our natural gas in Korea, in Japan, in Europe. And so I think there is a need. And the question now is, can we do it economically? Interestingly, in speaking with people who are looking into this, people on our Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and people who are have been involved in this for many years, one of the challenges that they're having is getting gas contracts from companies on the North Slope. Once again, Hilcorp. Hilcorp controls trillions of cubic feet of gas on the North Slope. And again, what I'm told is they're refusing to offer contracts. So, you know, what we're seeing is the state of Alaska being held hostage to these multinational corporations. And this is creating economic issues all up and down the state. And you know, unfortunately, we've got an attorney general who's willing to sit back and not take any action and continue to let Alaska be treated like a colony. And we need to exercise our sovereignty as a state. We're an owner state. We own the resource, the only state in the United States where we actually own the resources. And we're being whipsawed around at the whims and desires of these multinational corporations who continue to want to just extract the resource and not give Alaska a fair share for our resource, or not even extract the resource and just hold us hostage for higher prices.
If a gas pipeline was going to be built, how far off are the numbers in order to make a line viable in terms of sales volume to make it pencil out? We were just talking earlier about the Susitna-Wautana Dam project that could potentially cost $10 billion. What would it cost to build this gas pipeline? And when do you see that actually potentially being viable?
You know, you hear all different numbers and different time estimates. The latest that I've heard is the idea that we build the in-state portion of it first. I think my preference would be to see a larger scale line, a 42-inch, 48-inch line. You know, there's some talk about doing a bolt line. It's just not economic. When you do that small scale line, it's extremely expensive gas. If you do a larger line and you didn't have the LNG facilities, you could actually get that done, I've been told, within about 5 years. And you start pumping gas for in-state needs first. You get the line built. And then once that's going during that process, you're getting the permits and you're developing your LNG facility, which is a very costly aspect of it. But that would probably take another 5 years on top of that. So, you know, to get gas exported, you're looking at probably 12 years out. In terms of prices, again, you know, they're all over the place. I've heard the latest estimate is that they believe they can do on a large scale line in-state gas for around $7 to $8 per 1,000 cubic feet, which is about what we're paying right now in Cook Inlet. It's much cheaper. It'd be much cheaper gas for Fairbanks, but it would provide an enormous supply of gas for for Alaska.
In the short term, are all three of you in agreement that we're going to have to import some gas?
Yes.
Well, it's great
that
for Chris to say that.
Yeah,
that's Chris on the renewable side. You know, I think it's going to take a combination of Cook Inlet reserves and also the possibility of importing LNG. And I think we'll know this development season. You know, I'm not going to emphatically say yes, but I'm going to say it's highly likely. I'd like to go back to touch on Senator Wilkowski's point about the pipeline. You know, and first off, you know, Senator Wilkowski has been extremely engaged on this issue and really appreciate all his efforts down there, you know, trying to find, you know, long-term solutions. There have been a number of points in time for the state of Alaska where the market has needed Alaska gas. And to Senator Wilkowski's point, right now is prime. So with all the geopolitical events, with this, the massive demand over in Asia, the potential to reduce carbon emissions from coal over there, this is a massive opportunity. And I think, you know, with the AGDC's focus shifting it to in-state first, the biggest challenge with this pipeline, or excuse me, with this project has been the pipeline component of it. When you look back to, Governor Murkowski's days when he was talking about a pipeline down to Chicago, right? That project was viable up until the point where they had the large shale boom explosion, right? And then all of a sudden they had massive gas amounts, which lowered the cost of Henry Hub and everything else down in Lower 48. But one thing that's often not pointed out is Canada actually built a 2,000-mile pipeline from their reserves to Chicago. They did the second part of that. We just couldn't get it together in Alaska to do the first part. So these significant pipeline projects are built all the time, and Canada is a great example of that. They have 1,000-long-mile pipelines that they've built. One as recently as 2000, and there's one being built today. So the opportunity's there. We just need to all get on the same page. And to Senator Wilkowski's point, we could bring gas down from the North Slope at a much cheaper cost. Mm-hmm. That would go a significant ways towards energy security for the state.
So, Chris, you were quick to say, yes, we're going to need to import some gas, but you want Alaska to avoid a long-term LNG contract. Talk about why and what you think is reasonable for bringing in outside gas for the midterm.
Well, first of all, wind and solar are the cheapest electricity on the planet right now. They're already cheaper than our current natural gas prices in even a small project like the 8-megawatt solar project out of Houston. So we're already competitive with $8 gas here. Renewable energy is getting cheaper. Kodiak has been 100% renewable for some years. Their prices for electricity are lower than in the rail belt. People in Fairbanks and Homer are paying over 25 cents a kilowatt hour. People in this area are paying 20 cents a kilowatt hour. That's 50% higher than the national average. So we already have very high electricity prices here in the Anchorage area. So renewables are very competitive. And they're even more competitive because of federal tax credits. And those tax credits were extended for 10 years in the Inflation Reduction Act. They only go till 2032. If we were to get stuck in a long-term contract, let's say 8.5 years, which is how many years we have left with the tax credits, we would essentially be frozen out of the 40% off sale that the federal government is offering and the independent power producers are willing to take the risk to build. All those projects that I mentioned earlier are going to be built by independent power producers who take all the development risk, all the financial risk, and just sell power to the local utilities, similar to the way that John was commenting how the NSTAR buys power from a producer of gas. And the producer then is on the hook to actually provide that gas, just like an independent power producer electricity would be on the hook for selling that electricity at the price that they contracted for. The National Renewable Energy Lab just published a study that they worked on for over a year that demonstrates that every year we wait, we are not saving $100 million a year. Essentially, everybody's looking at the long-term projects like Big Hydro or a gas pipeline. Those are not going to help us 3, 4, 5 years from now when we start seeing a gas shortfall. And so the projects that are going to actually help us in the short term and can be built that quickly are wind and solar, backed up by batteries. And those can save us $100 million a year relative to the gas prices that the utility's own consultants have estimated to be $12 to $13, which is more than 50% higher than what we're already paying.
And in this National Renewable Energy Lab study, the context there is, it says Alaska, we would have to get to 76% renewable energy by 2040 in order to save that $100 million. Is that correct?
No. If we get to 76%, we would be saving $100 million along the way, starting as we build up the amount of renewable energy versus the gas we're displacing. In 2031, we'd start saving $100 million a year. By 2040, we'd be saving $120 million a year into the future. But what the NREL study said was the most economic pathway for the region on the electricity side is to install more wind and solar. And that's simply put, and that's consistent with what's going on in the rest of the world.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Dennis is trying again from Portland. Hello, Dennis. Can we hear you now? Dennis, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. Sorry. I had a technical issue there before. Two things. One, the Chinese are building LNG tankers at an incredible rate that are ice-breaking LNG tankers because they're buying gas from central Siberia near the Kolyma Peninsula, which is way the hell in the middle of Russia on the Arctic Ocean. And they're going to be using these, as the ocean continues to warm, they're going to be using these ice-breaking tankers. Building a pipeline is crazy. We should just build an LNG tanker terminal at Prudhoe if we want to sell our gas. That is, if Hillcorp would do it. But two, a couple of years ago, I don't remember if it was a regional corporation or a village corporation, but somebody announced that they're going to be working at a geothermal plant on the other side of Cook Inlet. I think it was near St. Augustine. They were going to drill thermal wells and, you know, pump water down, let the volcano heat it up, and use that steam to generate power. And that seems to me to be a really good, low-pollution, constant availability power at a relatively low cost, and you don't have, unlike when you have a hydro dam, you don't have a peak load issue because you could shut down a couple of turbines if you don't need the power at that particular time.
Okay, so geothermal options are something that you're interested in, and there has been some discussion about that. I saw one write-up about Mount Spur that said it's probably too far away. What about, is there any other potential that's closer to where it needs to be that any of you are aware of? I saw you nodding your head, John, Dennis was talking.
Yeah, geothermal is a fantastic resource. The state does have it across the state. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of a project that's close. And the challenge there is getting the transmission lines from those projects or from those resources to the population hub. So it pretty much with all these projects, it comes down to a distance and a cost factor. And unfortunately, I'm not aware of any that are in the vicinity, but geothermal is fantastic.
With Mount Spur, actually, the transmission is only about 30 miles. I think the bigger issue is the cost to where the transmission starts at Beluga. It's not that far. It's the closest to the large population centers that we have in the state. But it's a remote area to be doing drilling. And, you know, the state has a long history of supporting drilling for oil and gas. It would be nice if the state would also consider supporting drilling for domestic use. And this is the thing. We have never gotten a hometown discount on our oil and gas because it's a part of a world market. And that's really the problem we're talking about here is we're in a world market with oil and gas, and LNG makes gas a world market. If we could support our domestic energy use, first with some energy policy, but then with the types of things that we're doing to promote economic development through oil and gas exploration, I think it would serve the citizens well.
So, Senator Wilikowski, the mention of just taking gas right from Prudhoe Bay and putting it on barges or tankers right there at the water, has anyone looked at that? Is there any potential for something like that?
It's definitely something that people have looked at. You know, if you go up to the North Slope, what you'll see is that you can go out for miles on the oceans up there, and it's only about 5 to 10 feet deep. So it would be a really significant amount of dredge work, a significant cost to a port. Now, they are building a port in Nome, and that's going to be billions of dollars. And I've heard over the years, people in the industry say that's exactly their plan. They would rather wait until the ice melted in the oceans there, and then do exactly what Dennis suggested. That's one of the other challenges. So you've got significant dredge work. You've got you have the inability to use that gas for in-state use because you're shipping it out, which is I think for LNG really something that is critical for Fairbanks, for South Central, and then you still have the ice in the oceans. I think, and I agree with Chris completely on the idea of bringing more renewables. I think that's where we're headed in the future, for sure. The rail belt, we'll see significant more renewables. The challenge that we have is the heating problem. And we need natural gas to heat our homes, or otherwise there's going to be significant costs to convert people's systems all up and down the rail belt. So the heating and the gas continues to be an issue.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of energy generation for the rail belt communities as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Senator Wilikowski, I wanted to ask about, we had an email and a question from Frank about small nuclear power plants. We know that on Eielson, there's a project being considered right now. About a decade or so ago, there was a lot of excitement about the potential for a small nuclear power generation facility in Galena. And that just kind of went away, fell apart. But do you see potential here for that type of power in Alaska?
I think that potential does exist. We passed legislation in the last couple of years to make it open up the possibilities for small micro nuclear. And I know there are many people that have concerns over it, myself included. I actually voted against that piece of legislation because I thought rolled back a little bit too much on our protection, on our ability to protect our local communities. That said, I don't know that the technology is quite there yet. I know, we certainly have used these on nuclear submarines, that armed forces have used them for years. I'm not sure that the technology is quite there yet for these micro nuclear reactors, but I think we're getting close. And I think in the next probably decade or so, you will see these more discussion about these, particularly in rural communities that have extremely expensive costs, electrical and utility costs.
We had an email from former Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz. And former Mayor Berkowitz says, I would encourage development of a waste-to-energy plant using the resources of the Anchorage landfill. WTE could also offset energy that consumers approximately 15% of the gas from the inlet. The landfill also produces gas. Currently, that gas supplies Elmendorf, and if an intertie was built, could also supply Fort Rich, offsetting approximately another 5% of the inlet gas. Chris, your thoughts there?
Well, there is a resource there. I'm not 100% sure of what the percentages are, but this is the silver buckshot approach. We need to be doing things all over the rail belt rather than saying one thing is going to save us. The longer we wait for one thing to save us, the closer we get to a long-term LNG contract. And that is actually what's been happening over the last 15 years since DNR first started saying we're going to have a shortfall in 2027. And they consistently issued four different studies during the last 15 years that have essentially been ignored, because now we're at the edge of this precipice about to import LNG because we haven't diversified. We are still roughly 80-85% reliant on gas for electricity production. That number really hasn't moved at all in the last 15 years.
I want to turn to you, John. I know that you wanted to respond here, but first I wanted to ask you to help people understand about how the wells actually work. If it's a hot, sunny day in the summertime, most Alaskans are using very little gas. That doesn't mean that you can just cap a well and save it for a cold snap, correct?
Well, actually, the kind of how production works and how we utilize CINGSA is during those times of very low demand, we're actually injecting gas into the reservoir so that we can pull it out on peak demand days or days when there's significant.
Because you can't stop the production, right? It's got to keep producing?
Well, best case scenario for producers, they like consistent production, right? And any time you have these large swings, we're about a 10-to-1 swing from winter to summer months. So in the summertime, very, very low. To give you an example, over that cold snap that we had over 11 days, we consumed or delivered over 2.5 BCF of gas over that 10-day period. So
billion cubic feet.
Yes, thank you. And so that's also one of the challenges with renewables. You know, from our perspective, renewables are critical for the long-term future of the state of Alaska. It's very, very important we get those in play to be diversified, what Chris is talking about. But on times of peak demand, you can't rely on renewables, whether it's wind or solar, to produce power for folks. And so that's one of the reasons why you haven't seen that, is it's a massive cost when you look at the demand perspective, the peak demand section. And the other thing I'd point out, you know, in that NREL study, it was a great study, a lot of work put into it. But one of the things in the executive summary on the conclusions, it says, don't use this for policy considerations. This is a study to make sure that people understand the potential for renewables. And I think that's very important. It also mentioned that it was conducted over a compressed timeline. They didn't have the appropriate time to really dive into some of those things. So there's a lot of important things to understand about renewables and how they impact the total system. Definitely important for the future energy security of the state of Alaska, but it's important that we put them in the right context. It's not the end-all, be-it-all solution for natural gas.
Well, I do have to correct the record there a little bit. If you use wind and solar year-round and you have adequate gas storage, then what you're doing with the wind and solar is not waiting for that peak demand, as John said. What you're doing is you're storing the gas year-round, and then you have more gas when it's cold. That's how renewables play a part in the overall gas system.
And Senator Wilkowski, I want to turn back to you in our final few minutes here. There's some legislative efforts underway, incentives for renewable energy development, property tax relief, and incentives for independent power producers. I want you to talk a bit about that, and then also another piece of legislation in the Senate that would have gas storage facilities regulated by the RCA. What are the aims of these legislative efforts in service to this idea of shoring up supplies for the future?
For independent power producers, there is a provision in a couple of the bills that are moving through the legislature that would put them on par with the local utility co-ops. Currently, local utility co-ops, when they develop a power plant, a generation facility, they don't pay local property taxes. Independent power producers, however, do pay that. And so this would put the independent power producers on par with the co-ops and not have them assess property taxes, which the estimate is that that would cut the utility costs by about 10%. So that's the IPPs, and that's gotten very favorable reception. The local communities support it. There's widespread support for that. The other question was on gas storage, and so we have CINGSA, which was developed 12, 13 years ago. That's the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, and that has been tremendously useful. That has really bailed us out on a number of occasions. It effectively acts as a battery. It effectively, when in the warmer months, when we're not using as much natural gas and the producers are developing gas, they store it in these gas storage facilities. And then for colder days when we need it more, that we pull it out. So it's effectively a battery. What we're looking at is regulating this, because we don't have enough gas storage. And so there's concern that if we don't regulate this, then we may have situations. And this is something I've heard, that some of the producers have been requesting, or rather demanding, exorbitant fees to use their empty wells as gas storage facilities. And so this is something to try to protect the consumers, try to protect the utilities from price gouging by these producers who have empty wells, because this is a public resource, this is a public need, and we need to encourage these sorts of facilities because this is going to play an increasingly critical role for us going forward in the next few years, at least.
Here is a quick question by email in our final minute here. Doug writes from Fairbanks, would it be cheaper to build an electric power plant on the North Slope and transmission lines to the rail belt rather than build a pipeline to move the gas? Has anybody looked at that idea?
Yeah, it's been looked at. It's really inefficient, unfortunately.
I see. A long, long transmission line.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're losing power along the way.
Yep.
In just a few seconds here, Senator Wilikowski, the state has budget woes. How much can federal funding help in closing this energy gap?
Oh, tremendously. We have billions of dollars in federal funds coming in for a whole host of things. But there are a number of energy projects. And the biggest one, probably the one most important for this discussion, is $206.5 million in federal funds for a submarine line that would go, an electrical line that would go from Nikiski to Beluga. The problem with our rail belt is we have a very antiquated electrical grid. Our electrical grid wouldn't even be permitted in the lower 48.
We're going to have to leave it there, Senator. Thank you. I'm so sorry. That was such an important point. And I'm sure that you wanted to get to a submarine line would help us avoid disruptions like avalanches on transmission lines. Thank you to my guest today, Senator Bill Wilikowski, John Sims, president of NSTAR Natural Gas, and Chris Rose, the executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, on the phones. Ava White helped us out today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next
week. Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.